Welcome to yet another exciting season of Sisters in Conversation, the podcast. I'm your host, Tebelo Motsane. I'm an attorney by profession and the founder of a platform called Sister in Law, which is a platform dedicated to empowering women through legal education. On this podcast, I profile women of color in the legal profession in an attempt to celebrate their contribution to the profession. We journey through their individual stories of perseverance and resilience and overcoming challenges like imposter syndrome, racism, and sexism, to name a few. I hope you're geared up for what promises to be another insightful, informative, and empowering season. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to this podcast.
Digital helps you make international payments. Human brings you global specialists to support your complex exchange requests. Get a dedicated relationship banker, access to global wealth specialists, and international travel and lifestyle perks. Enjoy the complete private banking experience with private clients from Nedbank. Digital when you want it, human when you need it. Search Nedbank Private Clients online. See money differently. Nedbank, we are a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Welcome to another episode of Sisters in Conversation. I'm your host, Tebelo Motsane. I'm an attorney by profession and the founder of a platform called Sister in Law, which is a platform dedicated to empowering women through legal education. On today's episode, I'm joined by Princess Mohlahlo. She's an executive at ENS Africa in the law department and holds an LLB and LLM in labor law, both from the University of Johannesburg. She grew up in Alexandra and Bram Fisherville and Protea Glen in Soweto. Hi, Princess. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tebelo. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for availing yourself and for agreeing to be a guest on the podcast. I do have, you know, a number of listeners who indicated that they would like to hear your story. And I know whenever I approach people and ask them to come share their story with us, they're always like, oh, but I don't have a story. I'm just little old princess, you know. So thank you for availing yourself and for agreeing. It means that you do believe that you have one or two nuggets that can really inspire someone just by listening to this episode. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I really hope so. But yeah, I'm flattered that there are people who'd like to hear my story. I'm really flattered.
Wonderful, wonderful. All right, Princess. Without wasting any further time, let's get into, you know, the flow of things. And, you know, as I always do with all my guests, can you tell us a little bit about Princess? Can we start from your childhood? Who's Princess? Where were you born and raised? Well, I did actually cover that in your bio, but we'd like to hear it from you. What was your experience like growing up? Which primary school, high school did you go to? And how did that shape or inspire your decision to pursue law?
Thank you so much. So as you said, I was born and bred in Alexandra Township, just next to Sandton. Mm-hmm. At the age of 10, we were moved actually by the government to RDP houses back in 2001, okay. I think. Okay. So we were moved to Soweto, mm-hmm. basically the outskirts of Soweto, Bram Fisherville, next mm-hmm. to Roodepoort. So that's where I also grew up from when I was about 11 to around when I was 18, I think, around 18. And around 18, my parents then bought us a house in Protea Glen, Soweto, which is the nicer part of Soweto. So we moved to Protea Glen when I was already 18. I was already in varsity at that time. So most of my childhood was spent in Alexandra and Bram Fisherville. And I think the highlights of my childhood were really in Alexandra. I really enjoyed growing up in Alexandra. The community of Alexandra when I was growing up, where you could easily go next door to ask for a pinch of salt if you didn't have salt. Ask for some sugar if you didn't have sugar. And there was still that spirit of a child is raised by the entire village, basically. It takes a village. And I just grew up around people who also played a part in raising me as a child. So all of us, the whole community was accountable for the children who were growing up in the street. I grew up in 22nd Avenue. And I went to primary school in Iputeng Primary School. It's on London Road, there in Alexandra. That's where I did my foundational years. And then I also went to primary school in Limpopo. So my father is Mubedi. So from the Parane village. It's next to Jane First. The one nearest town is Jane First. So I went to primary school, Kosirukulwane Primary School. That's where I did grade 3 and grade 4, if I'm not mistaken. So I did 2 years of primary school there. That was a humbling experience, I must say.
I was going to say, how was the transition from like township to village? Because, you know, the two are actually worlds apart, you know, even a different province altogether.
It was a very interesting time, and it was a bit of a challenge to be away from my parents, number one, because they stayed here in Alexandra, and I was with my grandmother, who actually was pivotal in raising me from when I was a baby, and then went to go back to stay with her for 2 years. The transition was, I mean, as a child, the thing with kids is we're very resilient. So I enjoyed being with all of my cousins in Limpopo, but then the schooling system was quite different in that that school was very strict. It's the strictest school I've been in. It was very strict. The principal was very strict. You had to be there on time. You had to be dressed properly. Books had to be neat. And you had to speak English. As soon as you walked into the school grounds, you had to converse in English. It was very important that you conversed in English. And I understood the concept, trying to teach us English so that we prepare us for the workplace, I guess.
Yeah.
So it was very strict. And me being me, I mean, I've been a latecomer my entire life. So I think I got a lot of beatings at that school before being late. A lot of corporal punishment for being late to school.
So, it was still corporal punishment.
Exactly. So I got a fair share of beatings at that school.
Why am I imagining the strict principle of Yizo and then just seeing you getting a beating at school for being late?
That was it. So and then from Sirukulani Primary School, I was moved back to Johannesburg to stay with my parents again. And then that's when we moved to Soweto. I went to Dr. Mary Malahlela Primary School in Dobsonville. I was there only for grade 7. And then from grade 7 high school, I went to Forte High School. It's in Dobsonville. That's where I did my high school, my entire high schooling year. So yeah, basically my schooling has all been in public schools. Forte High School is one of the best high schools actually in Dobsonville. So I was fortunate to get into Forte. So I enjoyed my schooling. I enjoyed it, but I must say I wasn't the star of the class or anything like that. I was just an average pupil, actually.
I love that. You have said two things that I actually just want to touch on. The fact that you weren't the star of the show, and that's something that I really try to drive on my platforms as well. Like, we're not all going to be A students. We're not all going to have like a rich uncle who can get us into a good law firm. We're not all going to have, an all-rounded CV, basically. So in your varsity years, we're not all going to actually have time to volunteer. Some of us are really just trying to fight for our lives to get through varsity because we are the first in our families to attend varsity. So we're not all going to be the star of the show. But it's not to say that then that means that you're going to be mediocre.
Exactly. That is very important. That is definitely very important. I would say I was more of an underdog. I was that child in class who the teachers didn't pay attention to. Like, they didn't pay attention to because I didn't have the full school uniform. I didn't have my books covered in neat. I didn't have the stationery. I didn't have all of that. I mean, my parents did their best, but we were struggling a bit, especially when we moved to Brown Fisherville. We were struggling. I say whenever I'm asked about my childhood that I didn't know poverty. I didn't know that we were struggling until we moved to Soweto, until we moved to Brown Fisherville, and we were put in the RDP houses, and we were far from Johannesburg. You're now far from Sandton. I mean, Alex, you could walk to Sandton. You could. Yeah. You wouldn't sleep on an empty stomach, as in this thing to do. You can go get a peace job down the road and work and make money. And like I said, the community that we had in Alex, where I didn't feel that we were struggling until we got to Brown Fisherville. And then I experienced poverty and struggle for the first time in my life. And my father also got retrenched around that time when we're moving, may have been a couple of years before the moving. So he was retrenched. So now my mother was the only one with a job, but my father would get like piece jobs here and there to try and make ends meet. And my mother was a cleaner at at a hotel, Emperor's Palace. So her salary wasn't much and had to maintain a family of five at the time. So it wasn't much. So really humble, very humble beginnings in especially in Soweto. And then schooling Forte, and then from Fort. I mean, I started school, I forgot to mention this part. I started school when I was about four. So I matriculated when I was 16. So
yes. Matric, I was baby of the class. Yeah.
So I was the baby of the class. Like I said, I was just that child who's forgotten at the back of the class.
Yeah.
But I think when my teacher started taking notice was, and I remember this very clearly, was when we did our prelim exams in matric. So I matriculated in 2007. That was a very tricky year for public schooling because there was a huge strike that year, a teacher strike. Huge massive teacher strike. We didn't go to school for about 2 months, June and July. And so we didn't take our exams for that year. So all the public schools, especially Gauteng, we didn't take the June exams for matric. And you know how those exams are very important.
They set the tone, yeah.
They set the tone, and you need those results to apply to varsity. That's the other thing. So we didn't write those exams. So the only exams we did were the prelim, and we had to attend a lot of Saturday schooling to catch up because now we're behind. We were behind the independent schools. We were behind the private schools. We fell way behind. So we had to do a lot of catching up in 2007. So to all those matriculants who matriculated that year, I mean, I would give us a pat on the back because it was a very difficult year. So I think my teacher started taking notice of me when we did the prelim, because that's when I got high marks. So I got high marks and then I was pulled aside. I remember my English teacher said to me, listen, you got very good marks in your English exam and I would like to just mentor you for the final exam so that you can come up on top. My biology teacher also as well pulled me aside. My Sibedi teacher pulled me aside. My mathematics teacher actually also pulled me aside. We had this crazy mathematics teacher. His name is Doggy. So those who went to Forte would know him, Doggy. Pulled me aside and said to me, listen, you did very well in your mathematics. We were not expecting it. And so we want to just mentor you for the finals. So that's when I think I started taking notice that, okay, there's potential here. But I must say, not to take away credit for myself, throughout my schooling years, I may not have been the star of the class or whatnot, but I wasn't completely like at the bottom. So I did do my, I did try.
You were fighting for your life.
I was fighting, Tibetan, I was fighting.
That's all that matters.
So now they pull me aside, give me textbooks. Because remember, we're in a public school. Some of the textbooks we don't have. We have to share some of the textbooks and whatnot. So imagine studying and you have to share a textbook. I mean, it made it very difficult. So for the finals, I got to be given some textbooks to go study. They could see that, no, this girl has potential. And then I did my final exams. I didn't get any distinctions, but I did manage to pass. At that time, it was called merit. I don't know what it is now.
Yes.
Yeah, so there was an exemption, which is like a bachelor's. And then there was a school leave, which is just the pass, and there was a merit and then a distinction. So I got the merit, and I remember my mother always said to me, I want you to get such good marks that I want to be called up on stage to come and accept some sort of award. That was my mother throughout my schooling. So she never got that opportunity throughout my entire schooling until matric.
To finally get on stage.
That woman wanted to be on stage. She had told me the entire 12 years she wanted to be on stage. So I get the merit. I get called by the school to come to receive my merit certificate and a gift from the school. The governing body was there. I think the minister was also there and whatnot. So it was an event at our school. So I got called up on stage and I got my merit and I was there in my half uniform, you know, not fully uniformed and whatnot. Yeah, and I was with my father. My mother couldn't make it, unfortunately. She was working overseas. And then I got my certificate for merit. That was the first time, first recognition in my entire schooling. So that was a big thing for my mother. It was a big thing for my family. My mother is very education based. She believes in education and she pushed us to get educated. So that was a big thing for her. So yeah, so I matriculate. Why did I do law?
Sorry, Princess, before you move on to why you studied law, I just want to put in a comment there that you know, we always have these talks about transformation and representation, you know, just ensuring that there are enough Black women or enough Black people in certain spaces, and that it's not just, you know, male and pale. And the thing that kept on ringing in my head when you were just telling us about your matric year, I also matriculated in 2007. But when we speak about transformation, we really forget about all the challenges that exist from grassroots level. So if we're having the transformation and representation conversation when we are already in the workplace, it's almost too late, because there are so many other barriers that exist early on in one professional's life that are an actual barrier to them being the best version of themselves. Because I can't recall a teacher strike. I was in a private school in 2007. And so you and I have the exact same year of matric, but we just have different perspectives of that year.
You are so right. You are so, so absolutely right.
I'm just like, what? There was a teacher strike in my matric year. And I'm just like, so when we talk about transformation and all of that, the problems start very early in our lives. By the time we get to work, there's just too much pressure on us to deliver this transformation thing, when really the work, we should be doing it at the bottom.
You are so right. I mean, the systemic issues that we face, like you said, they start from the grassroots, from foundational phase, from primary school, where I just read the other day how our literacy in schools is so low, in the primary schools is so low. Those kids are the very same kids that we're going to need in the workplace, that we need to come and occupy these workplaces.
That also scared me as well.
Exactly. So if we're failing at that level, who is going to come up the ranks? High school, varsity? How are those kids going to qualify to get into universities if we're failing at the very foundational level? Okay, let's give the government the benefit of the doubt then, at the foundational level. Even when you get to high school, still there. I mean, like I said, we had issues with textbooks. We had issues with teachers. I remember we didn't have a geography teacher in matric for some time. We didn't have a geography teacher. And we expected to just learn on our own with sharing textbooks and whatnot. So even at that level, there's just so much that stands in the way of kids making it out of the disadvantaged background. So much. And then you get to varsity. Still many challenges there when you get there. And if you are fortunate enough to qualify for NAFSAS, then you get the funding, but there's still so many challenges to your learning. So there's just so many challenges that one has to fight against. It's just fighting. It's constant fighting until you get to the workplace, and you're still fighting even in the workplace. So it's a constant fight, I must say. Unfortunately, it's a constant fight for many, many, many children in the townships, many children in the rural areas. And I must say, I am fortunate. I see myself as being fortunate for having the privilege of growing up in Johannesburg. That in itself placed me in a position where I could access certain opportunities. Imagine someone in the most rural parts of South Africa, in the Eastern Cape or Limpopo or KZN, they would not have had the access to the same opportunities that I do. And yes, we do have those kids who manage to fight and get out. But we are the outliers. We are the outliers. And it shouldn't be like that. It should not be like that. It shouldn't be that you have to fight exceptionally to make it. It shouldn't. But unfortunately, that's where we are. That's where we still are so many years after our democracy. That's where we still are as Black children, and even more so Black female children. Like, we're still fighting this battle.
Black women are tired. And I mean, just while we're on the topic, I've asked this in previous episodes, but what is it that we as Black women who are here in this phase in our lives, what can we do to ensure that we keep on passing the baton? What can we do to ensure that transformation isn't just lip service, it's actually lived and not just spoken about?
I think it starts with where you are. I truly believe that charity begins at home. It starts with where you are, the little that you can do in your little part of the world. And if you're fortunate enough to have a platform like you do to make it broader, then you can do that as well. But it really starts with where I'm sitting as Princess. What am I doing for the people around me. And I start with my family, my cousins. I mean, in my family, I'm the first. I'm the first to ever even enter a university, never mind graduate. I'm the first to go in. To see the doors of a university, the first to graduate in my family, both my immediate mother's family and immediate father's family, I'm the first. So that in itself, the fight, number one, we fought, that is, that should inspire our cousins, those coming behind us, our younger sisters, those coming behind us. And then number two, the mentorship, mentoring those around us. And I try my best with the, my cousins around me to mentor, to help where I can, because now I'm in a financially better position, to help where I can, to for them to not have as difficult a journey as I did. So where I can help to put someone in school, I do that. Where I can help to put someone in a private school instead of going to a public school, I try to do that for some of my cousins. And also now being in the workplace, I try my very best and to mentor those women around me, the young women around me coming in, the candidate legal practitioners coming in. I call them into my office. I have a talk. I have this talk with them. Like, you know what? This is what you're going to be facing in this workplace. And this is what you need to equip yourself in the workplace. And I've had this talk with so many of the candidate legal practitioners who have worked with, and the young associates that I've worked with, to say, listen, my door is always open. So to really, what we need to be doing is making the road less thorny for those who are coming behind, less difficult for those who are coming behind us. And it really starts in small ways. And as we have more power, as we gain more power, more influence in whatever rooms we enter, just make the road less thorny for those coming behind you. And that's my intention, and that's what I've been trying to do. And I will continue doing that in the small ways that I can, in whatever room I enter, especially now as an executive and young executive. I just got promoted, guys.
Congratulations, young executive. I love that.
But especially now, having entered this phase in my life, that I see that there's a responsibility on my shoulders also to make the road less thorny, make it more pleasant for those coming behind me.
So I absolutely love that. Congratulations, young executive. But it is so important. I mean, you're right. These conversations are so important. They also serve as reminders to our own peers, you know, to other women who are even levels higher than us, to just keep on remembering to pass the baton. And these conversations are also important because that little girl in Bram Fisherville, that little girl in Alex, that little girl in Jane First, she needs to hear your story and know that she can also be a young executive female in a top five law firm, for example.
Thank you so much. I'm so inspired.
So yes, back to where I had cut you off earlier. You were just about to tell us why you decided to study law, or what that was inspired by.
Yes, so law was never in my mind growing up. I wanted to be an author, a script writer, or an actress. I was into drama. I did drama in my primary school in Alexandra. I did drama and poetry. I was into the arts. I wrote a lot and I read a lot. So I'm an avid reader. I read more when I was younger than I do now. I read a lot of books. So from reading books, I wanted to be... When I saw that, okay, being an author, script writer, whatnot, is not going to happen. I wanted to be a forensic pathologist from reading books. It's because I read a lot of crime fiction. So I read a lot of crime fiction and I read about forensic pathologists. And I was like, you know what? This sounds like a fancy job. This sounds like it's very interesting and fun. I want to do that. So in matric, we were taken to a career, what do they call them? Career Expo. Exhibition. Expo, yeah. Yes. At Vets. We got to Vets and I asked about forensic pathology, and they told me it took 10 years. I had to do 7 years of medicine and then so many years, and I had to have these brilliant results. And then I was like, okay, looking at my results and how I struggled through mathematics, I had to fight for my life through mathematics and physical sciences. I was like, there's no way I'm going to make this. And then my mother suggested, listen, why don't you try law? Why don't you do law? I mean, there's not much of a difference between forensic pathology and law. You still get the excitement of dealing with the law and whatnot. Well, there is a big difference. And my mother always wanted to be a lawyer. She wanted to be a lawyer, but unfortunately, due to circumstances, she couldn't. She was like, I've always wanted to be a lawyer. I'm a lawyer by nature. She likes saying she's a lawyer by nature.
I love that. I love that for your mom.
When she talks, her mother is a talker. So she's like, I'm a lawyer by nature. So when I applied to university, I applied to Wits and to UJ. I mean, I wanted to go to Wits because I think at that time, everyone wanted to go to Wits. It was university. I applied to Wits. I put in forensic pathology still as my number one option because I still had faith that, you know what, maybe I may just get these marks in the final exam. Who knows?
You never know. Exactly, right?
Exactly. You must always bet on yourself. So... So I applied for forensic pathology as my first option, law as my second. I can't recall what was my third, but it had to do with law. I think it may have been BA law or something like that. I don't remember. Mm. But my second was LB, and then my third would have been probably BA law. And then to UJ, I applied LLB as my first option. I think BA law was my second. I don't remember what my third option was. So both universities admitted me on the LLB part. So not forensic pathology. So I got admitted to Wits for LLB. I was excited. I wanted to go to Wits. And I was excited that I got admitted. But then obviously they send you admission letter. Now you have to pay registration fee. I remember the registration fee for Wits was 5,000 rand at that time. There was no way. There was absolutely no way you could afford that. And so you have to pay the 5,000 rand and then you do your NAFSA applications and whatnot. So my aunt, one of my aunts works at UJ. So she said, listen, just come to UJ. I'll help you put through this NAFSA application. The registration fee is less here. And the fees are generally less at UJ being a public institution. So that it's less. So, okay, I applied to UJ. And I applied for NAFSA at UJ. And then I said, yeah, UJ seems the best option. So I went to UJ. So I studied my LLB at UJ. And that's how I got into law. So essentially, my mother was my biggest influence. She was my biggest influence. And like I said, she was very pro-education. I remember when I was in grade 11, she took me after school. I had failed. I had failed a test or something. Yeah, my mother, you couldn't present her with bed marks. Like she, it wasn't a thing. So yeah, I got bed marks. And she said to me, clearly, you don't want to get out of the township. You want to stay in the township. And my plan, this is her saying that my plan is to get out of the township. If you want to stay in the township, we'll build you a back room here and you'll stay here whilst we move to the burbs, to the suburbs. And then she said, your problem is that you think life ends here. But life doesn't end here. You think these four walls are your entire life and it's not. If you don't get the good marks, you're not going to get out of the situation. You're not going to get out of the township. And that Saturday, I remember we got on a taxi, went to Wits. This was even before the Career Expo. We went to Wits. My mother took me to Wits first before the Career Expo too. And we got there. She asked for the prospectus. They gave us a tour of the building. She said, if you keep on getting these bad marks, you are not going to make it into this university.
Oh my goodness, sure.
You will not see the doors of this university. So you see these kids sitting there playing. Don't you want to be like them? Keep getting these bad marks and keep playing with boys there in the township. You won't get out of the township.
Yeah.
Those words have stuck with me my entire studying life. And even now in my work career, they keep ringing in my head. So
just keep saying to yourself, books before boys, books before boys, books before boys.
So my mother is a huge influence for me. She's been, big influence for me to study law. So that's why I really studied law. It's because of my mother. So I get to UJ. Okay, so we're doing law now. And I was a baby, man. I was 16 my first year. Like I said, I was 16 years old. My first year, I was a baby. I was excited to be at varsity, you know, the freedom now. I have freedom. But my parents were very strict. They didn't want me to stay at rest. So I traveled between home and UJ, I was staying in Soweto, so it's not so bad. Just took two taxis to get to town and then to varsity. I was studying through NAFSIS. The first and second year I studied through NAFSIS. It was a struggle. I must say it was a struggle being at varsity because now you need clothes. Now you need to, you're no longer wearing uniform every day. You know, uniform. What I like about uniform is that it shields you a lot. School uniform shields you a lot.
Absolutely. Because
if we are all in the same uniform, granted that some of us wouldn't have the nice Taffy's shoes or, looking prim and proper, but it shields you so much as a child that you don't get to be judged as to what kind of home are you coming from.
I actually even want to say it in Sesotho, like, iputabuhlaswa, like,
thank you so much. Iputabuhlaswa.
It picks you up nicely.
You've said it so much. And then once you remove the uniform, now you're at university. You're like, shucks. People are dressing. People are doing hairstyles. Because now in high school, nearly pushback. You know, the pushback hairstyle. That was it. Now varsity, people are doing hairstyles. People are braiding hair. People are wearing nice sneakers. And there you are as princess from Bramfisherville. Your parents don't have money for any of that. I mean, they're just scraping to put together money for you to get on a taxi to come to school every day. Now, clothes are a problem. Hairstyle is a problem. So first, second year, it was a bit of, yeah, I struggled. I struggled through varsity, struggled. But I pushed through. So get to second year, NAFSAS now drops me. And it dropped me because my father got a salary increase. And then that disqualified me. And it was a minor salary increase. I mean, I think the term for it is the missing gap. So I became part of the missing gap. So I didn't qualify for NAFSAS still, but we couldn't afford to pay for varsity. I mean, my now third year, going to my third year, NAFSAS had disqualified me. So I didn't have funding for my third year of varsity. I had to get a job. So I got a job. I was like, I need to work. I need to make money so I can help my parents pay for these fees. I got a job as a sales consultant for Verimark. So I was one of those people, you know, buddy twister. I would be there in the mall, as seen on TV, twisting onions, ma'am. For only 99 rand. I worked at the Verimark in Alberton. And I must say that was one of the best years of my life till now. Mm-hmm. One of the best years. It was so eye-opening. I got to learn a lot. I got to learn a lot about money. I got to learn a lot about sales, about working, just working, managing my time. So I worked on all of the days that I didn't go to classes. So I was never at home. For 2 years, I was never at home. So my third and fourth year, if I had classes Monday, Wednesday, Friday, then Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, I'm working. My father even used to complain to say, when do you rest? And I was like, I'm a child, I don't need to rest. I need to be working. So I worked to help my parents pay for my fees and to buy textbooks. Remember now it's fees and then textbooks.
Yes.
To buy textbooks as well. And textbooks are expensive. So I couldn't afford some of the textbooks and I would have to make copies. So luckily UJ, I think, gave us a stipend for copies. So I would use that stipend to make copies of the textbooks that I couldn't afford to buy. Or I would borrow from friends. I also had a supportive group of friends. So we would share textbooks and whatnot. So I'd borrow from friends and whatnot. So that's how I got through third year and fourth year of varsity, by really working. And then I think third year, that's when I decided I didn't want to do law anymore. I called my mom and I said, actually, I don't think law is for me. I wanted to do accounting. I was like, what are we thinking about this law business? Third year.
Don't start your mother in third year.
Even, let me tell you, that conversation is also another conversation that's etched in my brain. I don't want to do this. This is not what I want to do. It's hard. And it was very hard. Law of evidence, criminal law was very hard for me. And this is hard. The studying, the reading.
Law of evidence. I'll never forget that lecturer at UJ. Do you have that white man? I forgot his name. Oh.
I know who you're talking about. It was him.
Oh. Yeah, no. Okay. I understand why you wanted to tap out in third year.
Like, no, this is not for me. My mama said to me, listen, my dear, if you quit this degree right now, you're going to be a quitter for the rest of your life. Whatever you do, you're going to keep quitting. When are you going to just start things and not finish? You're going to start a trend in your life of being a quitter. Do you want to be a quitter? Are you a quitter? I said, no. I'm not a quitter. She said, okay, finish this degree. Once you're done, once you've graduated and you still want to do accounting, I will pay for that accounting degree, but I want my law degree. I want to do that
finish
law degree
first. Yeah, stay the course, finish this. Yeah,
stay the course. I've never forgotten those words. Like, are you a quitter? So I finished my degree. I'm like, I'm not a quitter. So I finished my degree. Fourth year, I fell pregnant in fourth year. beginning of fourth year, actually, I fell pregnant. So now I was 19, fell pregnant. Yeah, my mother was disappointed, but she didn't express it.
You're a baby. Yes, you're
still now at 19. I mean,
so we have like a similar story. I fell pregnant at 19. I was also at UJ, but I fell pregnant in my second year. Yeah, also at UJ. Oh, yeah, no.
There's something in the water there, UJ. There's something in the water. It's not us. There's something in the water.
It's not us. I agree. Okay.
So I fell pregnant. My mother asked me, what is the plan? And I said, the plan is to stay the course. Finishing, get articles, that is the plan. And then she's like, okay. And that's all she said. She never said a negative word about me being pregnant, if I'm being honest. My mother was just like, what is the plan? And I think she trusted me. She believed so much in me, and she trusted that, you know what, she's going to make it. Despite this hurdle now of her being pregnant, we're going to make this. We're going to make this. And I think I carried so much of her hope and so much of my family's hope that she's at varsity. And then when I felt pregnant, I think for me, I was like, shucks. Now everyone's going to look at me being the first one to make it into varsity, and now I'm pregnant. It's like, what am I thinking? But then it happened. Now my child is 11 years old, turning 12 in December. So here we are. So I fell pregnant, and then I gave birth December 2011. I remember I gave birth right after I took my last exam, tax law, horrible stuff. After I took my last exam, I gave birth. But I went to school the entire year with my pregnancy. I did law clinic with my pregnancy. I was there in the library with my big stomach and
I was also fortunate that I did the whole year. I wrote exams because the doctor at the time had told me that it would look like in December, right? So I was like, okay, perfect. But it was really difficult just navigating with a big belly, and obviously it's not the norm. So all eyes are on you the whole time, you know. I really had supportive lecturers, and no shame. My friends at the time, they really held it down. They made me feel normal. They really held it down. But then baby was born in January, and so I didn't miss any part of school, because then 2-3 weeks later, it was time to go register again and then start the
third year.
And I kept it moving.
It's amazing that you had to now go into third year with a small baby. I can't imagine how that was, because luckily for me, I was done. So you going now into third year with you.
Look, we are here now.
So I gave birth, and then now I'm done. I've graduated. And I also had a supportive group of friends, especially my one friend Kamelo. She was absolutely supportive. I missed so many of my lectures in my final year because I was tired. You know, when you're pregnant, you're tired, you're sleepy and whatnot. And she would go to class, send me the notes, make sure that I caught up with everything. She was so supportive. Okay, and then I finished my degree. Unfortunately for me, I didn't have articles. So now I want to now pursue this career. Now I've decided I want to pursue law. I've forgotten about accounting.
Accounting is out the window.
I want to pursue this, and I want to be an attorney. Now I need articles. I couldn't get articles. For 6 months, I was at home with my baby. And I think looking back, I was depressed. I just didn't know at the time what it was, but I was, it was a very sad time for me.
I hear you 100%.
Now I'm at home with a child and there's no job for me.
In that kind of space, you are actually isolated because you don't know if it's safe for you to share those feelings with your mom, because you're like, I've already disappointed her. So now I can't come every day. I'm so sad, you know?
Exactly. So,
and then also your friends don't have babies. There's no community of moms to support you, because you just feel like, me, I'm a disappointment. Like, who am I gonna go and lean on? There's just no community of support at that age, because you are just still overshadowed by embarrassment more than anything, and sadness, which we only learn later in our lives. It could have even been postpartum, but we didn't know what it was called.
That is so true. I think fortunately for me, my best friend that I mentioned, Gabriel, had also had a child, but she had hers in second year. So she was my pillar of strength, my beacon throughout the entire time. Even when I was at home struggling, she was my confidant. So she was the one person who actually understood the struggle. Yeah. I was like, dude, I'm struggling to get articles. I'm struggling to find a job. So I just stopped now trying to only search for articles. I just wanted a job. I wanted a job. So I remember I went to one interview. I went to so many interviews, David. I went to so many interviews. I sent my CV to so many places. One interview I went, I think it was for marketing or telemarketing or something. And we're sitting around the room. So they were doing a collective interview. And they went around the room asking people for their qualifications and whatnot. And then they came to me. I said, no, I'm an LLB graduate. The entire room looked at me. And they said, Sisi, why are you here? You're overqualified for this job.
Yeah.
I remember it was in Randburg and I taken a taxi to get there. I was wearing my nice graduation dress, my black dress that I wore on my graduation day. Because I interview, I need to look smart. I took off my heels on the way back to the taxi rank. I put on flip-flops and I cried the whole way from the taxi rank to home. Just thinking about it now, it just makes me emotional. Yeah. But I cried all the way home and to my baby. Excuse me. And I cried all the way home to my baby. Feeling like an absolute failure. Like, I have this degree. No one wants to hire me. I have a baby. Excuse me. And I just felt like an absolute failure. I cried in the taxi. I cried. Like, I didn't care who was watching.
Yeah.
I cried all the way home. So luckily for me, my friend, Yenakabelo, had gotten articles at a small boutique law firm in Observatory called Ruth Edmonds Attorneys. And she spoke to her boss to offer me articles. And then I went for an interview. The first interview, I didn't make it. But then her boss, Gabelo, spoke to her boss again. And then the boss called me to come. And then I got the articles. So that for me was the door that opened all of this up for me to be here today, basically. That opened the door and I got articles. I did my articles I started working in July 2012 after being at home for the 6 months. And luckily for me, it was only 6 months. I know many, many graduates stay home longer. Some are still staying home 5-6 years later, still looking for work. So I consider myself very fortunate. I know how hard it is. I know I've seen it. So I got the articles, did my articles at Ruth Edmonds Attorneys. It specialized in employment law. So we did a lot of only employment. That's where I learned employment law and got to love it. That's where my passion came from. I worked there, did my article, and then I worked as an associate for 2.5 more years after my article. So I was there for about 5 years, if I'm not mistaken. And then from there, I decided, you know what, I want bigger. I wanted bigger because there we were focusing on employment law, but representing mainly unions, trade unions.
Okay.
So I wanted more exposure and I said, you know what, I want to go to Sentinel. I want to go to the big firms. I want to get into the big firms. And I was told it's very hard to get into the big firms if you didn't do your articles there, if you didn't get your cum laude, if you didn't do, that's what I was told. If you didn't get cum laude, if you didn't get the top marks in varsity. And I didn't get the top marks in varsity. I scraped by. I fought in varsity as well. It was a fight for me to get through my degree. I didn't get the top marks. I didn't get many distinctions. I got some here and there, but not many. And then I was told, if you don't have distinctions, if you don't have cum laude, if you're not a brilliant student, you're not going to make it. If you don't have a great matric certificate, you're not going to make it in these big firms. I was like, okay, I want to see for myself if I'm not going to make it. So I got an interview at Cliff Decker Hofmeyr, and they hired me there as an associate. This was 2017, March or April. And I worked as an associate. I was seconded to one of their clients. So I was working there as an associate and also seconded. So I got to get some in-house experience as a legal advisor in-house. So that was a great opportunity for me. And then from there, I worked at Cliff Decker for 18 months. Yeah, just over 18 months. And then I wasn't happy there for many reasons that I won't mention. And I decided, you know what, I want to go elsewhere. And then I saw this job being advertised at ENS Africa for an associate in the employment department. I said, okay, this is Africa's largest law firm. Let me see if I can make it. So I applied for the job at ENS Africa, called in for interviews, and they were happy with me. And I was employed as an associate in 2019, I started working there, January 2019. I started off as an associate in the employment department. And 2021, I got promoted to a senior associate. And then this year, March 2023, I got promoted to partner. So I've been at ENS Africa since January 2019, specializing in employment law in the employment department.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Princess. Oh, I'm just battling to keep it together.
Oh my goodness. I was near tears. You heard my voice was cracking just thinking about it. I think this was very...
I'm just thinking about your friend and... Our friends have really gotten us through so much. Like, I'm just so grateful for the friendships I've built over the years, because just don't take my friendships for granted, eh? Like,
I must say, Dibelo, if something
truly bought.
No, it's so important. I believe in the presence of the higher power. And I say this because of the people that surround me. And sure. not only my family, but the friends that I've met along the way, the friends who have carried me. I stand on the shoulders of so many women. So many women have carried me up until this very point where I am right now in my career. I don't take any of them for granted. So many women, from my mother, from my grandmothers, my aunts, my friends.
You are so right about the women, mothers, aunts. I share this a lot, and I just, your story just resonates with me so much. Like, I don't know. I couldn't have been here without, I always just, you know, give my mom her flowers. She really played an important role in supporting me and ensuring that I'm the woman I am today. But the people that I actually don't give their flowers often are my friends, and they have really just fought the battle in empowering me. I'm just so grateful.
And the friends, remember, they are, it's by choice. It's by choice. They're essentially volunteers in your life. They are volunteers in our life. And I have...
They volunteer to come carry your cross.
Come carry your cross. And I have the most magnificent friends. I mean, the one, like, from Cabello all the way through to now, the friends that I've made at the companies that I've worked for, at Cliff Decker, now at ENS. All these friends, if I were to pick up the phone today and say, I need this, they drop and they come be by my side. And I appreciate it so much that I have so many magnificent women of note, women of substance in my life that have carried me and continue to carry me. I appreciate healthy friendships. And they're healthy. And that's what I also appreciate, which is also very important, to have healthy friendships. I have healthy friendships where we have healthy competition. There's no jealousy. There's no big, there's nothing like that. It's just love, absolute love. And honesty, we are honest with each other. They will call me to task. They'll be like, Princess, you're messing up here. What are you doing? Exactly. We call each other to task. We take it like it is so important, because this journey is so difficult. I mean, especially working in practice. Practice, and this is what I wanted to touch on. Working in practice as a practicing attorney is very difficult. It is very hard. And that should not be taken for granted. It is very hard. Especially as a mother, I don't know how women with young kids do it. And I say young because mine is now 12 years and I'm grateful that I had her adversity. Yeah. It is so hard, the pressure that we have to deal with, the work pressure. Also, if you want to climb up the ladder, climbing up the ladder is not easy. It takes a lot out of you. It takes a lot out of you mentally, physically, emotionally. You need a sturdy support structure. And that support structure can not only come from your family, but also those people you work with. So you have to have your little tribe in the workplace as well, which is what I have. You have to have your tribe with your friends outside of work as well, because you need that support. So for me to be where I am today, and for the promotions that I've mentioned, for me to get those promotions, it took a lot. And my mother being the first person that I would call crying, oh, they better not cry. I'm a crier, so I cry a lot. So
I'm just a cry baby. I just couldn't keep it together anymore. I was just like, okay, I can't hang up and and abandon the interview. But yeah, I know what you mean.
So I would call my mother crying, like, "Mom, I can't do this. I can't do this. This is hard. This is hard, Mama. I can't." My mother would motivate me to keep going. I would call my friends, like, "This is too much. I can't." They're like, "No, you're almost there. Just keep fighting. You're almost there." So for me to be here today, it took a lot. And it took a lot out of the people that were around me, supporting me, because I would lean on them so much. Lean, and I'm not shy here to lean on. I know that. So if you don't cry, if you don't speak out, they will kill you and say you enjoyed it. You must speak out.
Yep.
So I speak, I cry. I cry to my friends. When I have an issue, they know for a princess is an issue. I cry to my friends. That's why I appreciate them so much. But you know what? This journey, you can't do it alone. You cannot. You need a support structure, a sturdy one. Yeah. So that's how I've managed to get to where I am.
I have no words. I actually have no words. I'm just cold here where I am. I have goosebumps because I'm just like, you know, yeah, there's just too many names for me to mention, but I've had very, very close. You know, I think I also even get lucky that people who aren't necessarily in my immediate circle, they are also just invested in seeing me win, you know?
Yeah.
I've had many kind women in my life, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing. Yeah. We need to lift each other up. That is so amazing. That is really amazing.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, I googled the 18 months, Cliff Decker, but so at least I'll catch that part that I missed because I was just a mess. I'll catch it when I re-listen to the interview. if you hadn't already shared in that process when you were just telling us about how you progressed in your career, for somebody who's listening and they are interested in employment law as an area of practice, what does a typical day or a typical transaction look like for you?
So with employment law, what we do, especially at ENS Africa, because we are a corporate law firm, so most of our work is advisory based. So we represent mostly companies, so the employers. Mm-hmm. So my typical day or week would be doing a lot of advisory work for employers. So advising on anything related to the employment relationship. So from employment contracts, either we are drafting them or amending them or reviewing them. Advising on policies, so employment policies, what's new in the law? Do employers need to update policies? For example, we had a code of good practice on the prevention and elimination of harassment in the workplace that came into effect just last year. But I think a lot of employers are still getting to know it. So we are going around training employers on this code, also updating policies, harassment policies in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Also, we represent employers in disciplinary hearings at the CCMA, arbitrations or bargaining council. So I do my own appearances. I would appear at the arbitration and bargaining council. Also at the labor court. So if there are matters that need to go to the labor court, and most common matters are review applications. So where you've gotten an award from the CCMA or bargaining council and the employer is not happy with it or the employee is not happy with it, and they would take it to the labor court for review. So we'd represent the employers there. I'll draft the pleadings and then file. And then also when there are strikes and employers want to interdict the strikes, so we'll do court applications for interdicts, interdicting strikes. And then another interesting part, which you are likely to find in corporate law firms and less non-corporate law firms, is we do a lot of transactional work. So we get involved in transactional work, which I've now, I'm enjoying. Initially, I didn't enjoy it, but now I must say I really enjoyed seeing a deal come together. So our corporate commercial department at ENS would get involved in deals, let's say a merger between a company and another company, or a sale. Maybe our client is purchasing another company. There's usually an employment aspect because there may be at the transfer of the contracts of employment of those employees from one employer to the new employer, the purchaser, or just if there's a sale of shares, now this company is taking over the company, what does it mean for the employees going forward and whatnot? So who would advise on the employment aspect would get involved in doing the due diligence investigation. So just investigating what issues are in that company that our client is taking over, what client needs to be aware of. And then we get involved in advising on the drafting of the commercial agreements, just from an employment law perspective. And when you see the deals close and you see it announced in the newspapers that so-and-so acquired so-and-so, and you know that you were involved in that deal, that you were advised in that deal, it is so amazing. So that's a part of employment law that I think gets overlooked. So amazing. Our contribution there is so important because a lot of companies, employees are important. They have employees. So we get involved from that perspective. That's what I would be doing, either advisory or consultations with client, or I'm at the CCMA. Like this Friday, I'm going to the CCMA for an unfair dismissal dispute and advising on contracts. So that's essentially it. So in employment law for me, like I said, that my love for it started from when I did articles. I've only done employment law for the past now 8 years as a practicing attorney, plus 2 years as a, so for 10 years, essentially, I've been doing employment law. And what I like about it is because it's decided on equity, fairness and equity, as opposed to civil litigation, where it's mostly whether it's lawful or not. And mm-hmm. whether it's there's an element of fairness and equity. So it keeps evolving. It's forever evolving, employment law. It's forever evolving. You think you know it? No, you don't. So we are constantly learning. With each judgment that comes out, there's a constant learning curve to say, okay, now we're stretching the principle of equity and equality and fairness that much further. So there's constant learning. That's what I enjoy about it, that I'm a forever learner when it comes to employment. And the same can be said for law in general, of course, mm-hmm. but more so employment because of the fairness and equity principles that permeated so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much. That wraps it up so nicely. I think that's also a very important reminder to keep on, you know, telling people. At the beginning of our conversation, you had said you love reading, or you used to read so many books. And I wanted to say to you, nope, you are still reading, because I know how ever-changing the law is. So you know what? If you're coming into law, guys, just remember that reading has to be not even second nature. Kuri, you must just know that you're going to read.
You're going to read. You are just going to read every day of your life.
Sure. Thank you so much, Princess. Thank you for this beautiful conversation, for stirring up my emotions, for sharing your story so authentically and so beautifully with us. I really am, if nobody takes anything else away from today's episode, I hope they understand how important their contributions are in friendships. I think that's so important. I want to use this little minute to remind people of just how important friendships are. It can't always be about vibes. You can't have friends that you're scared of or friends that you don't respect, because these are the people that you want to build, and you also want them to be able to build you in one way or another.
So that is so true.
Very important reminder. I'm just looking at the time, and unfortunately I do have to let you go now, but just in 1 minute or one and a half minute, what are your last parting words? It can be aimed towards any young law student or any young student in general. It can be aimed towards a young legal practitioner who's just entered the working world, or just anything at all that you'd like to share with us in these last few seconds.
There's a quote that I live by that has carried me throughout my entire career. And I'm a dreamer, so I believe in dreams. I believe in dreaming, and I believe in believing in your dreams, no matter how crazy they may sound. So I always say, go confidently in the direction of your dreams. Live the life you have always imagined. And this is by Henry Thoreau. So whatever it is, whatever dream you may have, and you think at that moment as you're sitting there in Bramfisherville, as I was, or in Alex, or in Jane First or Diparan, whatever dream you may have, it is possible. Go confidently in that direction of that dream that you have, no matter what people say around you, no matter what people say. You need to believe in yourself that much. And I think that's what carried me, that you need to believe in yourself, in your capabilities, in your abilities that much that you can achieve it. And you are only who and what you believe you are. So if you believe you can achieve something, people around you will believe you, and the universe and the people around you will work towards helping you get to where you need to be. And I know it may, for someone who's sitting there thinking, listen, I've tried everything, it may sound like, okay, this is all fluff and whatnot, but I think you need to believe in something. Everything starts from believing something. And from there, the hard work will start. Then the hard work will flow from that dream that you have set your eyes on. I've always set my eyes on, from when I started finding that I wanted to do law, I set my eyes on being a partner at 30. That was my dream. And I made it just 1 year late. But that was my dream. And everything from that moment when I said that I want to be a partner at a big law firm, to be specific, I worked towards that dream. So you need to have something that's in the distance that you're working towards, and you go confident in that direction. And that for me was that dream, that I wanted to be a partner. And no matter what, no matter all the hurdles that I had to overcome, they were meant to bring me to this moment right now where I'm a partner. Yeah.
Sure. I love that. I love that so much, Princess. Thank you so, so much for your time. I can't thank you enough. And I know that our journey does not end here on this particular conversation. So thank you for officially agreeing to be part of the Sisters in Conversation Club. I now have you on speed dial, so you will be hearing from me again.
Thank you so much. I look forward to that.
All right, enjoy the rest of your day, Princess. I have to let you go now. Bye.
Bye.